Sunday, and it didn't happen. I was on a teaching trip in Eleuthera. That's an island in the Bahamas, and Southside partners with a ministry that does teaching and training in the Bahamas, raising up church leaders and just encouraging the community of believers there. And I was supposed to fly back on Saturday, flying out of Governor's Harbor International Airport, a small airport on a very small island of Eleuthera. Governor Harbor International Airport is probably, the terminal is probably about 4 times the size of this platform. That's the international airport that you fly out of Governor's Harbor. And there was one plane flying out that day, a commercial flight, small flight, 16 passengers and pilot and co-pilot. And we were supposed to fly out at 1:30 on Saturday, and about 1:20 we're on the plane and they're doing their pre-flight check, and the co-pilot looks at us and says, you need to step off the plane for a bit. We have an electrical question. So we all got off the plane and went back into the international terminal. They started to call Fort Lauderdale because it's about an hour and 20 minutes away or so by plane, and calling and trying to figure out what's supposed to be happening with the plane and why there was something wrong with the electrical system, and back and forth and back and forth, and finally about 3:30 they finished their phone calls and said, you need to come back in the morning. So the 16 of us that were supposed to fly out on that flight ended up finding other places to stay that night because they had to fly a mechanic and parts out from Fort Lauderdale to Governor's Harbor so that they could fix whatever was wrong with the plane. Well, what's the big deal? 3:30, an hour and a half later, the mechanic gets there, 5 o'clock, he starts working on the plane. We should still be able to fly out that night, right? No. Governor's Harbor International Airport has no lights on the runway. So once the sun goes down, nothing takes off or lands. And so we came back the next morning, and at 9:30 in the morning, met the mechanic, and the mechanic begins working on the plane. And so 9:30, 10:30, 11:30, 12:30, we finally fly away around 1:30. And we were all very glad that we had lost a few passengers somewhere in the process. They'd tried to find other ways off the island, because that meant the engineer got to fly back with us. And we knew if he was flying back on the plane with us, that we were probably good to go. And so, yeah, the engineer got back on the plane, but just talking with him, I talked with him about the process that he went through. You know, there was a problem with the charging system in one of the engines. It was just a turboprop, two prompt plane, 16 passengers. And apparently there was some problem with the electrical charging system. And he said, all I could do is I'd start with the first thing and work on that, check on that, replace the part. Okay, how does it fire up? Well, still a problem. So he just had to go through this series of steps. I'm really glad that he was very meticulous about going through the series of steps. Didn't want him to forget anything. Didn't want him to not replace parts that needed to be replaced. It took a while, but it was very important for him to go step by step by step to make sure that we got to the right destination finally. And I saw that. I watched him working through the process, and I realized that, you know what? That's probably the way that we should read. What I mean by that is I think there's something about reading that ought to be step by step. We pay attention to each step along the way in order to follow someone's train of thought. And that's really important when we read New Testament epistles. Because when we read something like Paul's letter to the Corinthians, sometimes I think we need to do the same thing, step by step, thought by thought, pay close attention. Because lots of times we take verses out of context. You ever know that happen? People take a verse and use it for all kinds of purposes, and it really doesn't fit what Paul is talking about or what Peter is talking about. And so one of the things that we do here at Southside is we work our way through whole passages of Scripture in order to understand what the Spirit-inspired author was saying so that we can hear what he's saying, what the Spirit is saying through him, and then ultimately what the Spirit wants to say to us. We want to understand what and why Paul is writing. He's writing in his letter to the Corinthians. He's writing to followers of Jesus who are very much like us. And yet, they're living in a different place and a different time and struggling with things that we may not be struggling with. And what he wants to say to them has some bearing on us as long as we pay attention and make sure we understand what he's saying to them. As long as we can get on board on what he's saying to them, then we can build a bridge into our own lives. And so that's what we're going to do. We're working our way through 1 Corinthians. Paul, he planted the church in Corinth. And after a while, he started to hear some things about the church, and he wrote them this letter about some of the things that he heard. But apparently, they had also written to him, because partway through the letter, he starts to address, now regarding the things you wrote to me about. And so we're in one of those, now regarding the things you've written to me about, sections. They had written to him about food sacrificed to idols. Back in chapter 8, verse 1, it says, now regarding the things sacrificed to idols. Now, we've been on that subject for quite so many weeks now. And we are going to come this morning to the end of that discussion. That is, at the close of chapter 10, Paul is going to wrap up his discussion of food sacrificed to idols. But in order to make sense of the ending, we got to make sure that we're on board. That is, we're going to go step by step. So that's what the building blocks are for. We're going to walk our way all the way back, starting in chapter 8, verse 1. That's where he introduces the subject. And if you notice on your handout, you have building blocks too. You need to start at the bottom of the building blocks. And we're going to build our way up and just try to make sure that we're on board with what Paul is talking about. Chapters 8, 9, and 10 in 1 Corinthians are not just a random string of beautiful pearls. They are really an intentional progression of thought. And in order to make sense of chapter 10, the last part of chapter 10, I just want to make sure that we're on board with the whole flow of thought. So we're going to start chapter 8, verse 1, where Paul is writing to the Corinthians, and he says, now concerning food offered to idols. That's where we start. Paul says, you wrote to me about that. Let me speak to you about the food offered to idols. The issue was food sacrificed to idols. The Corinthians had grown up in an environment where that was happening. And some of them said, well, we know. He says, we know an idol has no real existence. And Paul agrees with them. In those first 6 verses of chapter 8, he says, an idol has no real existence. We know that there is only one God for us. And so that's where the argument starts. If we were going to talk about food sacrificed to idols, we have to recognize that idols are nothing. They're not gods. And so Paul says there's that understanding. Now, as he's going to address the issue of food sacrificed to idols, he starts with that truth, but then he says, but you know what? Not all know this fully. But all do not fully know this. That's what he starts to talk about in chapter 8, verses 7 through 13. Not all fully know this. What he means is that, in fact, he says this. He said, chapter 8, verse 8, food will not commend us to God. We are no worse off if we do not eat it, no better off if we do. He doesn't say, you're not more spiritual if you do, you're not more spiritual if you don't, you're not less spiritual if you do, you're not less spiritual if you don't. But he says then, but not everybody knows this. And here's where he talks about the weaker brother. He's talking about a young, growing Christian who's grown up in a pagan environment and has not yet resolved for himself or herself what to do about this particular issue. So Paul says, not everybody knows that an idol is really nothing in the world. And so, he says, we may have to curtail our freedom. In this section, he says, you may have to curtail your freedom because there are some who haven't yet resolved it for themselves. And if they see you eating, they might go ahead and decide to eat before they resolved it for themselves. And Paul says, you might cause them to stumble. He's talking there about a weaker brother. One, not who knows what they believe, but one who's uncertain yet about what they believe. And he said, you might, although you know this, you might have to curtail your freedom in deference to somebody who has not yet resolved that. But that's not the end of the argument. Paul is going on to talk about other things, talk about the same thing in a different way. In chapter 9, although he starts talking about himself, he has not changed horses in midstream. He offers himself as an example, and what he says is, chapter 9, verses 1 through 18, he says, because I'm a minister of the gospel, he says, I am free to live by the means of the gospel. That's what he introduces in chapter 9. He says, I have a certain freedom. I am free to live by the means of the gospel. But then he says, but you need to understand, I refrain from exercising that freedom. He says, I am free to live by the means of the gospel, and he lays out a strong argument that those who preach the gospel and share the gospel are right to receive recompense for that and to be supported by those they minister to. He says, I can do that. He says, I'm free to do that. But he says, I refrain from exercising such freedom. He says, because I want to preach the gospel freely. Let me just help you make sure that you understand why he says freedom comes by not exercising that freedom. He says, I want to be able to preach the gospel freely. Now, a teacher in Paul's day would go from place to place to place and oftentimes be supported by those who like his teaching. So if Paul goes someplace and some Gentile Christians say, we really like the message you're bringing, Paul, so we're going to support you. Well, the next city that Paul goes to and he wants to go into the synagogue, they hear that he's supported by a bunch of Gentile Christians. The Jewish people in the synagogue say, we don't want to listen to you. You're coming from the Gentiles. Well, if in fact he was supported by the Jewish Christians in Jerusalem as he went out on his missionary journey, then when he went into Gentile cities, they would go, well, you're just one of those Gentile proselyters. One of those Jewish proselytes. We don't want it. And so Paul says, I have the freedom to be supported, but I don't exercise that freedom. I let that freedom go so that I can have what I want more. What I want more is to preach the gospel freely. So Paul is saying that I have the freedom to make my means by the gospel ministry, but I refrain from exercising that freedom because I want something even more than that freedom. Do you understand? He says, I have the freedom to do it, but I set that freedom aside because there's something I want more. And then, at the close of chapter 9, he says, and you all understand this. There are people who do this. That is, some curtail their personal freedoms. And he uses the example of an athlete. An athlete can eat whatever they want. An athlete can sleep as long as they want. An athlete can work out however much they want. But Paul says that athletes exercise self-control in all things. Why? So they can win. They have the freedom to do whatever they want with their days. But he says an athlete exercises, curtails personal freedoms for something they want more. He says everybody who runs in the race runs, but not everybody wins. And you know who the one who is who wins? It's the one who has exercised their freedoms and curtailed some for the sake of what they wanted more. So Paul is talking about this same kind of thing. Everyone know, I says, we know. Idols are nothing in the world, and so you are free to eat or free not to eat, but maybe the freedom to eat or not to eat isn't the big issue. Maybe you need to understand that everyone doesn't have this knowledge, and there might be times for you to curtail your freedom, just like I sometimes curtail my freedom because I want something more than that, and you all understand that because you recognize that athletes curtail their freedoms in order that they might have what they want most. Well, then he introduces Israel in chapter 10. Now, it's not like Paul just runs out of things to say, and so he's changing subject. No, when he begins to talk about Israel in chapter 10, verses 1 through 14, he's talking about Israel having been delivered from slavery. Israel now crossing the Red Sea, baptized into Moses, now given spiritual food and spiritual drink. Now they are experiencing life with God. They've been set free from their slavery. And how do they live? Paul says, you got to listen. You got to look at their example because Paul offers four examples, four pictures where Israel, in their freedom, gave in to whimsical cravings. And the result is they didn't experience the life that God wanted for them. they gave in to cravings and didn't experience the life God wanted for them. That is, in chapter 10, 1 through 14, we get to see what Israel learned about freedom. What Israel learned about freedom. Drawing on Old Testament illustrations for our example, he says that they did not all experience the life that God had for them because they gave in to personal cravings. And in fact, you could put it this way, giving in to cravings is just another kind of slavery. It's not full freedom. That is, in fact, Paul closes that section 10, 1 through 14 by saying, therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. What is he referring to there? If you are living merely to satisfy your cravings in freedom, then you are living as if the cravings are the most important thing, and candidly, that's idolatry. If, in fact, you're free to eat meat, but you gotta eat meat, then you're back in bondage. That's idolatry. So Paul says, of course you're free. You can eat meat or not eat meat. It doesn't make you more spiritual or less spiritual. But do you have to? Or could, in fact, you could curtail your freedoms for something that you wanted more? And that's how he then gets to where we are this morning. That is chapter 10, verses 15 through 22, as he draws this discussion to a close. Now he's going to take us to the end of the discussion as he wraps up his thoughts about food sacrificed to idols. This is the last block, the top block, the end of the discussion. And so I'm going to read through the passage, and we're going to talk as we go through, and then we're going to ask a really important question. So what difference does all this make to us? Because, I mean, it's been a long time since I ate meat sacrificed to idols, so what difference does this discussion make to us? That's what we'll ask as we come to the end of it. So let's start. Chapter 10, verse 15. So, part of the conversation, ongoing discussion about how do you experience and live fully in your freedom. That's what he's talking about. How do you... The presenting problem is food, sacrificed idols. The big issue is how do you live fully and experience life as one who is free. Chapter 10, verse 15. I speak as to sensible people. Judge for yourselves what I say. The cup of blessing that we bless, is it not a participation in the blood of Christ? The bread that we break, is it not a participation in the body of Christ? Because there is one bread, we who are many are one body, for we all partake of the one bread. And consider the people of Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices participants in the altar? So what am I implying? That food offered to idols is anything, or that an idol is anything? No, no. I imply that what pagans sacrifice, they offer to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to be participants with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Shall we provoke the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than he? Now, this is not, like I said, a random thought. It's just not like Paul doesn't know what else to talk about, so now he's going to talk about the Lord's table. In fact, a little later on in this same epistle, he is going to talk some more about the Lord's table. But he introduces this idea here because he wants them to think about how they do life. And the first thing that he talks about is participation. He uses that word. Some translations render it fellowship. You fellowship at the table. You fellowship at the table. You fellowship, or you partake and you participate. What is he talking about there? He's talking about having intimate, shared life. He says, Corinthians, you know that when you take communion together, you are embracing the life and the blessings. He doesn't have a sacramental view. He doesn't think that something happens that way in communion, but that's what we're celebrating. We are participants in Jesus' life. We share in the one cup. And then he says, and we're participants in one another's life. There's just one bread that we collectively share. So he says, Corinthians, you know that when you take communion, you're celebrating your active participation in Jesus' life. And he says, even Israel, when they offered sacrifices back in the Old Testament, there was a participation that went on. It's not like they ate the altar or ate God, but they shared in the blessings that flowed from the altar. He says, Israel participated in the sacrifice. They had a partnership in it. There was an intimate sharing that was going on. And so he goes, but don't you understand? Although you're free to eat, and we know that idols are nothing in the world, that is, they're not gods, you need to understand that if you eat the meat in the temple ceremony, then you're participating in the worship of demons. And he says, that should not be. So he's not left the subject of eating meat sacrificed to idols. He's simply saying, but if in fact the meat that you're eating in the at the table of the pagans where they're worshiping, if you eat in the temple, then you share in the presence and power that's there. And he says, I don't want you to do that. So he would say, don't participate in their worship. In answer to the question about eating meat sacrificed to idols, he says, with regard to the food, if it's part of the worship service, don't eat. Because you're sharing in that experience. Don't eat. Don't open yourself to such influences. But here's the basic idea. It's in verses 23 and 24. This is the theme we're going to come back to that's woven throughout these chapters. All things are lawful. Are there rules that control what I can and cannot eat? No, Paul says all things are lawful. In fact, that's what the Corinthians would be shouting. All things are lawful. But Paul says, but yes, but not all things are helpful. Everything doesn't benefit you. And they said, all things are lawful, but you know what? Not everything builds up others. Certainly you are free, but the question is, what are you doing with your freedom? Certainly you are free to eat, but why are you pursuing that freedom? Is it the most beneficial thing to you and to others to exercise that freedom? That's what Paul is saying. Well, then he says, verse 25, well, Paul, okay, so you talked about in the temple, so I can't eat in the temple, but what about when I go through the marketplace and there I see the food, can I? Look at what Paul says, verses 25 and 26. Eat whatever is sold in the meat market without raising any question on the ground of conscience, for the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Because what would happen is meat would be sacrificed to the idols and there would be a temple ceremony there where you could participate in the meal. And Paul goes, don't do that. But if they don't eat all that food, then they take it to the marketplace and they sell it. And Paul goes, hey, eat and buy whatever you want. There's the freedom to eat and buy. Because he says, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it is his, which means, that's shorthand for saying where it ultimately came from was from God. And so even though it passed through the pagan temple, it was still God's. You receive it with thanksgiving. It's perfectly fine to eat. That's fine. You're free to do that. Eat and buy, and he says, without a question of your conscience. That is, he says, don't let it trouble you as to how it got to the meat counter. Just buy it and eat it. Because you're not participating in the pagan worship service. He says, don't sit at that table. But he says, once it's left that table and it comes to the marketplace, then you're free to eat. But then the question might get raised, okay, but what happens if I'm invited to dinner? That's actually the next issue. Verse 27, if one of the unbelievers invites you to dinner and you're disposed to go, eat whatever is set before you without raising any question on the ground of conscience. Corinthian Christians, growing up in a pagan culture, have friends who are not yet saved, who do not yet know Christ, who do not experience life with him, and they invite you to dinner. What should you do?
Well, no, I never eat with unbelievers.
Well, that's ridiculous. Jesus ate with them all the time. You're welcome to eat with them if you feel comfortable doing so. And Paul says, when you go, if they offer you food to eat, then eat. This isn't a worship service. This isn't a temple. When they offer you food, you are free to eat. And he says again, don't let your conscience worry about how it got there. Just, you can freely eat. So, he says, with regards to food in the marketplace, don't worry about buying and eating. With regards to a dinner invitation, he says, don't hesitate to eat what is served. Except, there's one exception. And here it comes. Verse 28. But if someone says to you, this has been offered in sacrifice, when you're at their house for dinner, then do not eat it. For the sake of the one who informed you and for the sake of conscience. I don't mean your conscience, but his. For why should my liberty be determined by someone else's conscience? If I partake with thanksgiving, why am I denounced because of that for which I give thanks? What's he saying there? I know this has never happened to us, so we have to try to put our heads around this. I mean, it's like not like you go to a dinner party and someone brings out the hors d'oeuvres and says, oh, just to let you know, we were offering these to Molech back in the kitchen before we brought them out to you, you know. Or this bratwurst, right? This bratwurst was lifted up to Baal before we topped it up to offer it to you. No, we don't have that kind of experience. And so what are they talking about? Well, there are some who would have come from a pagan temple and have gotten their meat as meat offered to idols. And when they come home, they offer it to you and they say, idol meat, this came from the temple. Now, Paul is saying, I would be free to eat, but he says, not for the sake of my conscience, but for their conscience, I'm not going to eat. Did you notice that's what he said? It's not about his conscience any longer, he says. But if someone says to you, this has been offered in sacrifice, then do not eat it for the sake of the one who informed you. And for the sake of conscience. He says, I don't mean my conscience. What's he saying? Well, if you're in a... And again, this is not the kind of experience we normally have. We just have to understand the Corinthian issue. They're in a pagan house, a place where there are unbelievers, and the unbeliever is graciously offering food and then tells you as a Christian, knowing that you're a Christian, goes, oh, by the way, this is meat sacrificed to idols. Why would they be telling you that? I think they would be telling you that because they think it must make a difference to you. They don't yet have figured out in their head that idols are nothing and that demons are inhabiting their temples. And they don't have it all figured out. But they know there's something different about you, so when they offer you the food, they go, oh, by the way, this was meat sacrificed to idols. Paul says, for the sake of their conscience, don't eat it. Why? Because they don't know how to make sense of what it is that you're about. I have freedom to eat it, so I'm just going to eat it. And this pagan doesn't know how to make sense of that. The reason why they told you meat sacrificed to idols is because they think that probably matters to you, right? That matters to you, that it's meat sacrificed to idols? Thank you for telling me I don't think I'll eat. That is what Paul is talking about. For the sake of their conscience, to not cause them trouble in their thinking, don't eat it if that's how it's offered to you. So Paul is bringing his conversation about meat sacrificed to idols down. This is not about, this last section is not about the weaker brother. It's about the unbeliever. And Paul says, I'm free to take, I'm free to eat, but in that context, I'm going to curtail my freedoms. And then he draws the whole discussion to a close at the end of chapter 10. So, here's the bottom line. Whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Give no offense to Jews or to Greeks or to the church of God, just as I try to please everyone in everything I do, not seeking my own advantage, but that of many, that they may be saved. Be imitators of me as I am of Christ. Do you realize how often those words are taken out of context? Whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Is that true? That whatever you do, you should do all to the glory of God? Yep, absolutely. In this context, what's Paul talking about? He's saying, when you are exercising your freedom in eating and drinking, make sure that you do it in the bigger parentheses of to the glory of God. That's what he's saying. He is talking about eating and drinking. And food sacrificed to idols. He's answering that question. And he says, yes, you have freedom. But do you appreciate the glory of God more than you appreciate your experience of freedom? That's what he's saying. So certainly you're free to eat and drink. But use your freedom for what you want most, that is, for the glory of God. Whatever you do, even your eating and drinking, should be done for the glory of God. Notice what he says, give no offense to Jews or to Greeks or to the church of God, just as I try to please everyone in everything I do, not seeking my own advantage, but that of many, that they may be saved. What is Paul saying? Is he saying that I really want you to live as men pleasers? I want you to live on the whims of others? I want you to do things to impress others and win their favor? No, I don't think that's what he's saying at all. I don't think that's what he's saying at all. Paul says throughout this section, I want the freedom to share the good news about Jesus with as many people as I can. It's like Paul has a holy disease. I'm going to do everything I can to infect others with this holy disease. And anything that gets in the way of that, I let it go. I curtail my freedoms because that's what I want more. He wanted to do all he could to have the freedom to preach the gospel to all who need to hear. He curtails his freedoms so that he can have that freedom. When he says, I try to please everyone, ultimately he's pleasing Christ because he wants to be in favor with everyone so that everyone that he meets, he can have the opportunity to share the gospel with them. And then he invites his readers and us to imitate him, live that way. So what are we supposed to do with this? We didn't write to Paul and say, hey, Paul, can you explain to us what we should do with meat sacrificed to idols? We didn't write that question. Most of us, it has never crossed our mind. Most of us will never encounter that particular situation. So what are we supposed to do with this? Should we simply brush these chapters off as anachronistic? They're unapplicable because we don't have a problem with meat sacrificed to idols. Or maybe should we try to lift a verse or two out of context just so that we get something out of the chapters? Or maybe we should reduce all of 8 through 10 to rules. They're just kind of rules that we need to adopt. No, I don't think that's the case. See, the meat sacrificed to idols was the presenting problem that Paul is addressing. behind it was gospel thinking. And he addresses the problem with gospel thinking. And what we got to get our heads around is what the gospel thinking is that informed this discussion about meat sacrificed to idols. Then we can make the application to ourselves. Let me tell you the two big ideas that I think run through this section. God has set us free from our slavery to sin and death so that we might freely enjoy life with him. You're free. Absolutely. You're free. All things are lawful. You can richly enjoy all that God provides, even meat sacrificed to idols once it meets the marketplace. Take it and eat it and enjoy it. You are free to enjoy life with God. In fact, I think Paul would encourage us to do all we can to maximize our joy and our satisfaction in God, our intimacy with Jesus and our fellowship with him. Anything that you do that moves in the direction of maximizing your experience of intimacy with Jesus is an appropriate expression of your freedom. That's one track. Here's the other track. But God has brought us into that freedom within the context of a community so that we can enjoy this life with him, with others. And therefore, doing all that we can to maximize our joy in him and our satisfaction in him, doing all that we can to maximize our intimacy with Jesus and our fellowship with him is always the right thing to do as long as we have our eye on the fact that we're not doing it alone. We're doing it with others. In a sense, it's not about rules. The guidelines that he offers here in the last part of chapter 10 are simply outgrowth of really good gospel thinking. And I hear it throughout these chapters. He says things like, in chapter 8, verse 6, he says, "For us there is one God." We all affirm that. Yes. The Father, from whom are all things, and listen, for whom we exist. You were set free. For what reason? To exist for him, to live for him. And one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and through whom we exist. You are free. Free from that in order to live this. Does that shape your thinking? Does the reality that you have been set free in order to experience intimate fellowship with the living God, does that shape your thinking? Chapter 9, verse 19, Paul says, "For though I am free from all, I have made myself a servant to all, that I might win more of them." What does he want? I am so enjoying this intimate life with Jesus, this rich blessing. I am going to do everything I can to get everybody else infected with the same holy disease. It's like someone who goes on a mission trip for the very first time. It happens every mission trip that I know of. You go on your first short-term mission trip, and you come back, and you are convinced everybody needs to go on that mission trip. They all got to go do that because it was so life-changing. And so, that Paul is that way about the gospel. Jesus has so changed me. I want everybody to have this life with Jesus. So I will curtail my freedoms if they get in the way of what I want most. What I want most is more people to experience this life with Jesus. So I'm gladly lay aside certain freedoms for the sake of getting others in on this life that I'm experiencing. Because he says in 9:21, "I do all for the sake of the gospel, that I might share with others in its blessings." That's what underlies all of this. How do you think about food sacrifice to idols? He gives us the specifics, but behind it is, "But I do everything for the sake of the gospel so that I can share in the joyful blessings of the gospel and share that with others." So he can say in 10:23, "All things are lawful, but not everything is beneficial." All things are lawful, but everything doesn't build up. So though all things might be lawful, I'm going to do the things that build up. I'm going to do the things that are most beneficial. So then he can get to 10:31 and say, "So whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God." Does that shape your thinking? Or do you reduce it to rules? Or take a verse out of context? How am I getting my head and heart around this? I would say this. With your freedom, in your freedom, live for what matters most. Don't settle for less. Don't cave in to whimsical craves like the Israelites did. But live for what matters most. You are free. You're free to buy a car. You're free to buy a home. You're free to read whatever you want. You're free to watch whatever you want. You are free to you're free to sleep in next Sunday. You don't have to come to church. You don't earn brownie points from God by coming to church on Sunday morning. You're free never to open your Bible again. You do not secure your place with God by doing dutiful things. You're free. You are entirely free in Christ. The question then is, what will you do with your freedom? Will you live for the things that matter most? Will you just trot along with the runners, or will you run like you want to win? Will you just kind of beat the air, or will you actually constrain your freedoms so that you can fight well? What will you do with your discretionary time? How will you spend your minutes and dollars and talents? You are free. But what are you doing with it? What are you doing with your freedom? I came across an article yesterday. I know you all know about the Fukushima nuclear plant and the trouble that's going on there. Massive trouble. There's a group that are referred to as the Fukushima 50. They are actually a group of about 300 people who have been working in shifts of 50. They can't put them all in at one time. You only work in a shift of 50. You go in for 15 or 20 minutes, and then you have to leave. They have become heroes in Japan. Speaking to the news by phone via an interpreter, the mother of one of the 32-year-old workers said her son had told her they must already have been exposed to lethal doses of radiation. She explains, "My son and his colleagues have discussed it at length, and they have committed themselves to die in order to save our nation. He told me that they have all accepted that they will all die from radiation sickness in the short term or cancer in the long term. They have concluded between themselves that it is inevitable that some of them will die within weeks or months. And they know it is impossible for them not to have been exposed to lethal doses of radiation." So what are these 300 people doing? They're free. They don't have to go back into that plant. What are they doing with their freedom? They're doing something that matters more. That's what Paul is talking about. What are you doing with your freedom? Are you doing with your freedom something that matters more? Or do you just while away your hours? Do you just idly spend your time? Do you just piddle around with life? Or are you living for what really matters most? This discussion about food sacrificed to idols is not unapplicable to us. It is about what you do with your freedoms. Will you live for what matters most? I was thinking about how I could bring this message to a close in a little more upbeat way than 300 workers going to die. And so my mind went back to one of my favorite movies. It's called The Princess Bride. I know some of you know that movie. Okay. The Princess Bride, it's about a princess named Buttercup and her beloved young man named Wesley. And when the movie opens, you're introduced to Wesley and Buttercup. And Wesley's, all you know about Wesley is when Buttercup asks him to do something, he's a servant in her household. And when she asks him to do something, he simply says, "As you wish." And you come to discover the reason why he says, "As you wish," is because he loves her. And so he does whatever she asks him to out of real love. He curtails his freedom. He's heading this way, and she says, "Will you do this?" And he says, "Well, of course." And he does it because of love. He curtails his freedom. For it becomes the big message of the movie, for true love. True love. And Wesley ultimately wants to make Buttercup his wife, and so he has to make a living, and so he goes off out of the country in order to make a living and gets captured by the dread pirate Roberts. And there you later learn that he pled with the pirate to spare his life. Not because he wanted to live, but he said, "I have to live because of her. I promised I'd come back for her. I told her I would come back for her. You cannot kill me because that matters most to me than my life. Don't kill me." He's living for something that matters more. He curtails his freedom. He ends up taking over the pirate ship of the dread pirate Roberts in order to make his fortune so that he could come back and rescue her. He comes back. Oh, it's a wonderful movie. He comes back and rescues her, and they go through all kinds of terrible tortures and finally ends up with a very happy ending. It is a kissing movie. That's part of the line from the movie. It's sweet and clean and wonderful. But the thing that you get out of the movie is Wesley curtails his freedoms for what matters more. You get it? I'm going to sacrifice that. I could do this, but I'm going to sacrifice that because this matters more. I could do that, but I'm not going to do that because she matters more. How is Paul living? Paul is living, I have all kinds of freedoms, but I will not exercise my freedoms if they don't get me what matters more. What matters most to you? What matters most to you? Is it seeing the kingdom grow? Is it participating in what Jesus is doing? Is it enjoying deep intimacy with Jesus and with others? Is that what matters most to you? Then you know what? Some of your freedoms might be curtailed. That's okay. Paul, in the opening words of this letter, says, we have been brought into fellowship with Jesus Christ. You have been brought into intimate life with Jesus. Intimate life with him to be experienced richly. Do all that you can to maximize that. Let go of whatever freedoms you have in how you spend your time and spend your days and spend your money. You have the freedom to do whatever you want with that, but why would you give in to whims and craves and not live with your freedoms for pursuing what matters most? Do all that you do for the glory of God. Do all things for the sake of the gospel. All things are lawful, but not all of them are helpful. What are you doing with your days and time? Do all that you can to make the most of your life with Jesus. Live for what matters most. It is him. Live for him. Let's pray. Help us to see you. Help us to see you as good and as glorious and as precious and as valuable and as awesome and as spectacular as you really are, so that in joy we would forego all kinds of freedoms for the sake of enjoying you more, knowing you deeper, for the delight of experiencing life with you. Let us lay aside all kinds of whims, cravings, and fancies. Not so much for sacrifice's sake, but for delight's sake. For the joy of having life with you more deeply, more richly, and for sharing that life more richly and deeply with others. Jesus, draw us into such a life that all that we do for the glory of the Father and our delight in you and the power of the Spirit, for the Spirit of faith.